Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
HRN has a brand new look, but we're sharing the same delicious stories. Invest in the future of food radio by becoming a monthly sustaining member at heritageradionetwork.org/donate. Hey, 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 welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on Heritage Radio Network. It's Tuesday, July 13th, 2021, and we'll be talking about another show about craft malts with some new friends of ours. So we're going to go around the room and introduce ourselves. And again, this has been a really special summer. We are talking to people all over the country, and craft malt has been a big focus for us this summer. So let's take it around the room. Let's start with Emily. Please introduce yourselves.
Hi, Jimmy. I'm Emily. I'm glad to be back. I'm calling in from Durango, Colorado at the Radcraft office.
All right. And thank you for helping organize this show. And next is Phil.
Hi, Jimmy. Yeah, I'm Phil Newman with Main Stem Malts, and I'm calling in from Walla Walla, Washington.
All right. And Brandon.
Hey, Jimmy. Brandon Howard. I'm calling in from Juneau, Alaska, where I run Amalga Distillery with my wife.
Great. And Kether?
Hey, Jimmy. This is Kether Scharf-Gray. I'm with Main Stem Malt, and I'm calling in from Seattle, Washington.
Great. Well, welcome back to the show, Kether. So, Emily, why don't you just run us through why you put this show together? Because we did a show a couple weeks ago about women defining craft malt, but this is a very important story, I think, about regions of agriculture and connecting with, you know, what is the agriculture behind beer. And that's why I'm really excited about craft malt. And you guys have done a great job of helping to bring on a lot of guests to talk about that. So what's the story with Main Stem Malt, and why is this a good story for us?
Thanks, Jimmy. Well, you used the word connecting, and I think that's the key here. Main Stem Malt is really diversifying what it means to own and operate a small malt house business. And they're doing so in this very human forward and conservation minded way. And that's really what attracted me to these stellar humans who are teaching me so much about not just craft malt, but where it comes from and then where it goes as a final product. But these folks additionally are just so rooted in their community, in their region, in their commitment to craft malt, and also in their commitment to the diversity, equity, and inclusion conversation, which I think is a component of a lot of modern day businesses that I really admire. So for all of the above, I was stoked to get involved with them and to actually contribute to their WeFunder campaign, which is something that the Amalga Distillery has done as well. So I thought that in the spirit of connectivity, it would be a great conversation, not just talking to the folks at Main Stem, but with a couple of their partners today as well.
That's great. So now, Brandon, why are you on the show? I think you are an investor in the WeFund. And just tell us what's so special about Main Stem Malt for you as a distiller?
Yeah. So we are an investor in Main Stem. You know, I've known Phil for a little while now. And I mean, do you want the long story or the short story?
You can
Jimmy?
Do the long story. This is long form.
Okay. Oh, great. Good. Yeah. So a major component for us in making a craft American single malt whiskey, you know, when we started down this path, American single malt wasn't really a buzz. You know, when we started 4 or 5 years ago. You know, I think Westland was really kind of forging the way, but also one of the few few producers. And something that we really wanted as part of our long-term business plan, right? Because when you start making whiskey, you're kind of always thinking long-term, was to have a supply chain that we were really proud of, a supply chain transparency with, you know, malt that wasn't necessarily commodity was something really important to us. But kind of the bigger long-term vision that we had was using Alaskan-grown barley, because there's such a fascinating story with Alaska-grown barley that a lot of people don't know, and a lot of people don't realize that Alaska has this agrarian component to it. And, you know, I think it was back in the 70s or 80s, there was this really kind of crazy story of, you know, what Alaskans known as the failed barley project or failed barley experiment, which is when the state pumped, I mean, millions and millions and millions of dollars into investing in farmland and infrastructure to be able to produce barley, but they gave it no end market. There was no real purpose to it. It was just recognizing that barley could grow in the state, and so let's grow it. And sadly, you know, all this farmland is developed and cultivated, and all of the barley that we grow in the state, regardless of the quality of it, just goes to feed, and people haven't really found anything to do with it. So I have this personal belief that the project wasn't a failure. The farmers did what they set out to do, which is grow barley. I think it was just a little ahead of its time, because now all of a sudden, you know, the state of Alaska has so many breweries, you know, and new breweries popping up every year, and several distilleries. And all of a sudden, there's this really interesting and incredibly high dollar value consumer that wants, that can use this Alaskan barley. You know, my distillery could use so much Alaskan grown barley. And so, you know, it started as a pet project for us, where we were doing experimental floor maltings of Alaskan grown barley. And we had one that was going well in a lot of ways, but also failing terribly in a lot of other ways. And I kind of posted a half joking, you know, SOS, help us out here, on our Instagram, when I saw that Mainstem Malt, you know, we posted a picture of our floor malting, and Mainstem Malt commented on it in a positive way. And I saw, oh my goodness, there's a malt house commenting, and we need a lot of help. And so ended up reaching out to Phil, and, you know, his long-term vision of what craft malting can be and Mainstem's approach to it really fit well with our long-term vision of what the state of Alaska needs for malting, right? We need a malt house, but we also need a lot of groundwork and a lot of, you know, a lot of groundwork laid between here and, you know, the state having a malt house or several malt houses. You know, there are a lot of trials that need to be done, and a lot of information that needs to be gathered. And so, you know, malting isn't my expertise. I make whiskey. And I knew that I was going to need someone or something like Mainstem and Phil. And so, you know, short term for us, using Mainstem Malt is a source of pride and supply chain transparency that we really value. You know, we love, we love the business, and long-term, what we're really excited about is the relationship and the potential to have a Mainstem hub in the state of Alaska, which, you know, is my personal end goal.
That's great. That's a great intro, Brandon. Now let's just go to Cather and Phil, and just bring us up to speed. Cather, you were just on a recent episode, so we know a little bit of your backstory. But tell us what Mainstem's doing. Is Mainstem just a malt house?
No, that's a good question. I would contend that Mainstem is also, when you talk about a hub, we're also a hub of communication and of relationships. And I think that's kind of the best part of Mainstem, is that we are the combination of many powerhouses, and you know, a supply chain is not just the malt house, it's everything that's built around it. And then also it's all of the people who back it. And so that's kind of the cool thing about Mainstem for All and about equity crowdfunding, is that we are more than a malt house, because we're serving malt to brewers and distillers. They're serving beer and spirits to the people. And that's a way for it to kind of all wrap up. And so I kind of see Mainstem as a bigger project overall.
So where are you guys right now? Do you have one location?
Yeah, I can step in on that, Jimmy, if you don't mind.
Go for it, Phil.
Yeah, so we're actually a bit of an odd duck in that sense in the craft malt community, in that we're the only craft malt brand so far to really grow without our own physical malt house. So we've grown in partnership and collaboration with now three different craft maltsters in the Craft Maltsters Guild community. And so it started off in 2016. We had our we contracted for our first barley crop, and we're trying to build a malt house in Milton Freewater, Oregon, and which is in the Walla Walla Valley. And we couldn't get it financed. We had this relationship to fall back on with one of the founders of Link Malt and Link Foods, the co-op that operates the malt house. And I went to Craft Malt Academy in Winnipeg, Manitoba, back in 2015 with Joel Williamson. And so, yeah, there was this relationship to fall back on where they had extra capacity. We were able to do some contract malting through them, and we're able to get the brand going. And we subsequently added Skagit Valley Malting as another one of our malting partners. And so then it became this supply chain management model that seemed to actually carry some weight. If we could grow a brand that could flexibly use capacity across multiple malt houses that needed to make more efficient use of their plants, then man, that's a valuable service in and of itself. And then also, yeah, if we can then, and goal for Mainstem has always been supply chain sustainability, and specifically starting with conservation on family farms. And so we're not so concerned with you know, we want to know our stuff about malting. We want to have artisan chops, so to speak. It wasn't a deal breaker for us to not do our own, to do malting in our own facility. So that kept us going. And since then, we've been able to add more recently add in Montana Craft Malt as our newest malting partner, which they're operating the largest craft malt house in North America. So now we're benefiting from some economies of scale there that we haven't seen before. And so, yeah, we're technically based in Walla Walla. We want to build our one of our first two specialty malting hubs in Walla Walla. But currently it's my wife and co-founder and I living in town here, and with some big dreams of what's possible. And then this distributed team, we have Kether based in Bellingham and three sales reps, our customer innovations team, located up and down the I-5 corridor. And that's pretty much Mainstem right now. And a network of partners.
When I think about malt, what I like about malt is it's similar to what I like about cider and apples. I just think about this big country with all these agrarian regions. And how does malt fit into like a regional agricultural, you know, zone? Because there's, you know, Brandon was talking about growing barley in Alaska. Let's try to tackle this bigger picture of first, like, what are the regions and how are you going to fit in with them, you know, with Mainstem and your network? And just let's talk like that. Big your agricultural vision or something. And Phil, first, just tell us how you got what you studied in school, because you studied something about water, but then that really connected you to ag. And then you mentioned Walla Walla, and I think of sweet onion. So we're in the earth right now, right?
We are, yeah. Okay, so I'll try to weave my way through to basically, like, yeah, kind of how I got into malting, and then yeah, a little bit about the regionality of it in terms of grain production and where the malt's being used by customers, and then pass it off to Kether for just to talk a little bit about kind of who we're working with as growers and how we see that expanding over time. But generally speaking, background first. My background's in environmental studies, natural resource conservation. Formally, like that was kind of my career track. It was specifically water resource conservation and management. And then, yeah, I went to Oregon State University. I got my master's in water resources there. I graduated in 2011. And then we ended up moving out. Alyssa and I ended up moving out to Walla Walla. And we ended up moving out to Walla Walla. And then I started a job working for a pilot local water management board here that had me working as a liaison between basically consumptive water users like irrigated farmers and cities, and then also fisheries managers like the tribes and the state and federal regulators. And I've always had this fascination with agriculture. Alyssa and I have this common dream of someday doing a little bit of farming ourselves, but it's a really challenging thing to try to start a farm if you don't come from a lot of money or a lot of farmland, and value added is really the key. If you want to pull it off, you need to figure out how to not sell into the commodity market. So that got us thinking about how we could possibly make a go of farming through value added enterprise. And we went through quite a few business plans trying to figure out how to make that work. And grains were definitely on our radar as something that was one of the possible ways of doing it. And so, like, milling for flour or oil seed production, these were some ideas. But and then actually my mom tipped me off to Valley Malt in Hadley, Massachusetts, what I would call one of the first.
Right on.
One of the first wave craft maltsters, like River Bend, Colorado Malting Company, and them. But so yeah, she took me off to craft malt, and thanks, Mom. And then kind of everything pretty quickly came together. I was getting frustrated with my day job and the pace of change. Saw the idea. There was this concept of, like, market based solutions to conservation, where you can, you know, use if you can some way find a way to get farmers out of commodity systems and pay them a premium for growing certain crops, then, you know, you can get them to do things that are outside the scope of what they're currently doing conservation wise, and get them to, you know, do bigger, better, more sustainable things. So yeah, Mainstem craft malt came into the picture as I was looking into these market-based approaches to conservation, and it just, yeah, it was a kind of a beautiful confluence of all these things. So, yeah,
that's a good big picture. Yeah. And then are you drinking a beer from one of your WeFund buddies?
Yeah. So I'm drinking right now. I'm drinking a sour from Quirk Brewing, made with our Evergreen Pale, and it's specifically a blackberry sour. So it happens to be blackberry season for us, and this is made with one of our flagship malts, new to our customer base now. So it's a particularly exciting beer to drink on a 102 degree day. And yeah, Quirk was also one of our it's like, as we were starting this business, and it was just this crazy idea, we weren't quite sure how it's going to all work out. This brewery was starting in town. We don't have many breweries here. We have 180 wineries or something like that. But but only a handful of breweries. And so it's been a nice bond with them growing our businesses together.
That's great. And Kether, you want to talk a little more about the big picture?
Yeah, for sure. So, I mean, on the broad scale, right now we work with a suite of farmers who are our mainstay, and we've worked with several of them since the very beginning. And as we think into the future and we talk about access to farmland and equity of access, I definitely look forward to a future when we have a diverse group of farmers that we're working with and purchasing from. That's something that I see in the future. I guess that's about where I would leave that for the moment.
You know, if you have your network up, let's say you've got a couple hubs in a couple spots, and it enables select farmers to participate in this, you know, grain to malt system, and there's these hubs of malt, you know, craft malt facilities. What's the typical size that one of your farmers could be? Like, how small could a farmer be and make this work for them?
Yeah. Thanks for asking that. I haven't done too much math on that, but it's a question worth thinking about. If you consider that a farm that we work with usually gets about 2 tons per acre, and we need at least almost 40 tons for a batch, I would say that we need at least 20 acres allocated to us by a single farmer. That's not really accounting for the risk of their yields, et cetera. So I would be curious about working with a smaller scale farmer. They, you know, certainly have to have experience in growing malt quality grain, since, you know, not every crop that we take in is malt quality, which means that we don't accept those lots. And so it would be worth thinking about in the future. Who can we work with? How do we team up on that? It's certainly easiest to work with farms that are managing larger scale operations. I think that the smallest farm we work with, I'd have to think about it. I bet Phil knows the answer, but about 1,000 acres probably. Well, that's my memory's guess. But I would certainly be interested in considering someone smaller that has experience growing malt quality grain.
But you guys are out west also, so things are different. I just keep thinking about little farms in New England or in upstate New York where, you know, you don't have quite the flatness or other things to have large tracts. How is it different out there? I mean, I know you said it's 102 degrees. Is hot and dry good for barley?
Yeah, great question. Speaking of the farm size, farmers out here have, so we are in one of the richest wheat production regions in the country, if not world. And so farmers are really good at growing mostly soft white wheat. And that goes a lot of different places, but the majority goes to Asia, actually. And so farmers are growing on at scales that allow a large commodity system to efficiently convey boatloads of grain to other countries. And so that's set the tone for agriculture in general here. There are small farms like New England that serve local communities and where folks have found the ability to get that value-added play or direct play where they can stay small. But the commodity system here dictates that farms have to be big if they're going to stay in business. So a small family farm in the Walla Walla area is like 3,000 acres. You have to be really clever to make it work on less than that. Not to say that that's, I mean, people are doing it, but you have to be very clever, and pick your, kind of pick your markets wisely. So from a climate perspective, a growing climate perspective, the, inland Northwest or Columbia Basin, inland interior Columbia Basin, we have a range in rainfall that can go from 7 inches to 25 inches pretty easily. And so there's a big gradient there to play off of. And those different, whether you're on, if you're on one end, you can't grow very much. You can either grow wheat or nothing, typically, is what the farmers can get away with. And so there's a wheat fallow rotation. And then at the upper end, there's a lot more crops that they can grow, including beans, peas, and lentils, and malting barley or feed barley. So we have to be selective about where we contract for malting grain, specifically where we're growing, or we're asking farmers to grow dry land for us. So all the grains we buy are dry farm, so to speak. And so, yeah, we have to pick locations that are going to receive where that spring green up in our landscape is the longest. And so we look for places that receive a reasonable amount of precipitation in June. The month of June is really important. And fortunately, we have a fairly reliable climate here. This is a challenging, very challenging year for everybody. But by and large, it's been a reliable place to grow quality malting barley for farmers in certain locations. So, by summertime, it's hot. It's real hot, then dry.
Emily, how do you go about, not how you get your clients, but how did you end up working with MainStem? And I also want to ask you, are all your clients as cool as these guys? Because you've got a Malga and there's like pictures of a little kid, skipping down the road with lilac bushes. And it's just like everything looks so beautiful out there, whether it's Colorado or Walla Walla or Juneau, Alaska.
Well, we like to tease you on the gram, that's for sure, Jimmy. I met the folks at MainStem and Amalga through just a series of really amazing connections. And generally speaking, that's how we play it at Radcraft. We're very lucky, I should say, to just have a lot of interesting stories and fun connections as to how we meet people. And MainStem was no different. I work heavily with the Craft Maltsters Guild, and I'm just a huge advocate of what they do. And last year, Jesse, who was on Beer Sessions a couple weeks ago, the executive director, asked me to do a marketing seminar in collaboration with Alyssa, who co-owns MainStem. And that was how I first got introduced to this exceptional brand. And flash forward about 6 months after that, maybe longer or not, what is time, but Phil reached out to see if I might be interested in helping them communicate not only this WeFunder campaign, but just really help them with their comms as a whole. And I learned quickly that to tell MainStem's story is also to tell the stories of their many partnerships as part of this interconnected tissue that they're all in this supply chain together on. And that was how I first got to chat with Brandon. I actually called him up a couple months ago expecting to maybe have like a 10 or 15 minute conversation about what he does and why he loves working with MainStem, for the sake of some social media posts I was putting together. And flash forward over an hour later, Brandon and I were still on the phone, and I'm just, I'm really inspired by what they're doing in Juneau. And it was Brandon who actually helped me understand that part of this relationship between Amalga and MainStem, and in general, MainStem and all of their partners, actually comes down to salmon as a cultural icon, really, that Brandon helped me understand. It's deeply a part of what they do as Alaskan residents, and it's deeply a part of what MainStem does with their Salmon Safe Malt program. So I have answered your question and then some, but I just cannot say enough about how inspirational these two companies are. And everybody at RadCraft is this cool, but I think we're in a particularly badass group today.
Well, then now we'll go to Brandon. So Brandon, what is the connection between Salmon with you and MainStem?
Oh my goodness.
Well, Salmon as a cultural icon. Wow.
Yeah. I mean, so I live in Southeast Alaska, but throughout the state of Alaska, salmon is the lifeblood of this state, right? Like, we have more coastline on Alaska than, you know, any other state by so much. And, you know, the waters here are so important, so valuable, and, you know, for centuries, for, you know, thousands and thousands of years, salmon have been one of the most, or probably the most essential food source. We have the waters of Bristol Bay, one of the most productive sockeye fisheries in the state, certainly in the world, actually probably the most productive sockeye fishery in the world. Just locally, you know, I go out fly fishing, and it's something I enjoy, but it's also the way that I stock our freezer to feed my family throughout the year. I commercial fished for 5 years, and in the state, you know, there's this constant and intense wrestling of natural resources. You know, Alaska is a state rich in natural resources, but logging, if it's done wrong, destroys streams and salmon habitat. Mining, if it's done wrong, you know, it's an essential part of our state. Those natural resource extractions are so important for the state's economy. If it's done wrong, can destroy salmon habitat. And, you know, of course, the same thing with oil. Like, these are all things that are important. We need these for the health of the state. These industries are important. They give people jobs. They produce wealth for the state. But at the end of the day, our most valuable resource, both for financial health of the state, but also for just health, you know, I think it sounds maybe like a stretch to say, but I feel comfortable and confident saying, for really the spiritual health of the state, you know, protecting this natural resource of salmon is crucial.
That's a great one there. I'm just going to say, in Union Square Green Market in New York City, there's a native person. He's an activist, and he's out there at the farmer's market regularly. And you know what he says? He says it over and over all day. You won't believe this. He was just thinking about you guys. He says, water is life. Life is water. Life is water. Water is life. And now that you're saying it, I'm like, that guy knows everything. So let's just take a short break. We'll be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio. All right. HRN is excited to unveil the new look of Food Radio. We have a new brand identity and a new website. Our site makes it easier than ever to discover new podcasts and dig through our archive of 16,000 episodes. It's been 12 years since HRN started broadcasting Food Radio, and we've made it this far thanks to the support of our global listening community. It's because of member donations that Beer Sessions Radio is on the air with 30 other weekly shows. Your contributions give HRN the security we need to stay on the air during the pandemic and are allowing us to reopen our studio. Becoming a monthly sustaining member of HRN shows how much you care about Beer Sessions Radio and Food Radio, what it means to you. Hey, 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 welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on Heritage Radio Network. Check us out. We got a great new website and logo, heritageradionetwork.org. It's a great time to become a member and support us. Heritage Radio Network. Org. So we're talking about water is life. Life is water with the kids from Mainstem Malt and Amalga Distillery. Brandon, you got me inspired now. And Kether and Phil. So the connection of salmon with from Walla Walla and Alaska. What other connections do you have with some of your other, malt and farming partners, Kether?
Yeah, that's... I think that all of our farmers have a conservation ethic. They all care about their land like they're passing it on to their kids because that's what they aim to do. So they're all making decisions based on their waterways and based on their aquifer and trying to keep water in stream. And their continued success in farming, they're very clear that it's rooted in environmental conservation. So while there's, while salmon is certainly like the greatest node, there's also all of the work that our farmers put into, keeping their riparian areas in good shape, keeping their pollinators on their farms, keeping, just being very thoughtful about, the way that they're farming, and making decisions that are, that allow that to perpetuate into the future, that allow that to continue to be a livelihood into the future.
Wow, that's pretty profound. Hey, are you drinking something, Kether? Drinking any beers or spirits or anything?
I'm in Seattle, and my favorite brewery down here is Lantern Brewing. So anytime I'm down here, I try to drink a Lantern Brewing beer. They have a beer called the Apricots, and it's sour with apricots in it, and it's apricot season. And I'm just all in. It's my number one guy.
I hear they're a craft malt certified brewery, Kether.
They are. It's true, Phil.
Let's talk about craft malt certified.
Yes.
And how does that play into what Mainstem's doing?
Yeah, that's a good question. So craft malt certified, shout out to the Craft Maltsters Guild. And full disclosure, I'm also a board member on the Craft Maltsters Guild. And one of the initiatives there is to help our participating, our member brewers and distillers incorporate the messages, the diverse messages of craft malt into their products. So, and not just their products, but their companies as a whole. So brewers and distillers are able to certify as a company, and then also individual products for usage of craft malt. And right now the threshold is at 10%. And so if you use more than that in individual products or as a company, then you're eligible for, and you're a member, a paying member of the Craft Maltsters Guild, then you can use our suite of logos and messaging to help communicate that story. So it's a pretty substantial challenge for any brewer distiller to like figure out how to tell that story. And so this is just an easy way for them to have like one, malt house, like universal icon that says we support what all the craft maltsters are doing.
Yeah. Hey, let's talk about the difference, malts. I'm sure there's a lot of differences in regional grains and malts, but the difference between making malt for whiskeys like the single malt whiskeys versus making it for beer. Who wants to tackle that?
Brandon's probably a good one to carry this forward, but just off the or just to speak for a number of our distillers who are making American single malt whiskey, it's very similar. They're following very similar practices that a brewer would. And so their focus on malt quality is, pretty unique in the broader whiskey business. And so they are basically trying to make really good beer first, minus the hops, and then distill that into something special. So right out of the gate before any barrels are involved. And so for us, the malt, the pale malt, they're all buying pale malt for the most part. And for us, they're buying the same pale malt that we would sell to to a discerning craft brewer.
Brandon, you want to go with that? Let's talk about the American single malt whiskey distillers like Amarga.
That's dead on. I mean, I think that a big way that American single malt distillers are differentiating themselves is by paying attention to the quality of the barley. And, you know, not just using the most basic distillers, pale two row. You know, we're interested in more than just volume of alcohol that you're producing from the grain. We're interested in the character of the grain and proving that there's a character to the grain. In our barrel house, you know, we're a small, really small facility. But some of our favorite barrels are single varietal barrels, where, you know, we use just one variety of malt to make whiskey so that we can show the difference in character. We're using the same barley that brewers are using because we strongly believe that, you know, the character shows through, but also that by brewing a really great beer to start with, you end up with a better end product. When I talk about distilling with people, I always mention that, you know, there's no alchemy involved anywhere in the process. The flavors that you have in your whiskey, if you want those flavors present, those, you know, really delicious flavors, they have to come from some part of the process, right? So they have to come from your grain, your fermentation, a good healthy fermentation, or the barrel. You know, nothing, there's no magic involved. And so something that makes our whiskey so unique and, you know, something that makes me really proud of it is that we use excellent quality grain, and, you know, use not just distiller's yeast that, you know, has incredible efficiencies, but at the end of the day doesn't contribute any real flavor.
Wow. You know, Brandon, you had also mentioned supply chain transparency when you were talking about doing the WE fund. How does that play out with malt? I mean, when I think of that, is a good comparison to like the old days of wine where you had negotiants who were just doing blends of entire regions. And then there became this thing called estate bottled wine. Is this something that we're trying to do with craft malt now? Is go all the way down and recognize the farmers and the malt houses?
I mean, that's the dream, right? You know, so on one level, kind of revisiting, you know, the salmon safe thing, you know, farming isn't, you know, if we have barley grown here in Alaska and we have malt coming from Alaska, you know, we're going to have to do it in a responsible way and be mindful of, you know, our streams and our waters. But it's also going to be such an exciting story to tell, like that, you know, the barley that we're making our whiskey from is grown on these gorgeous farms that, you know, in the backdrop are these incredible snow covered mountains. I mean, it's surreal to see the landscape that a lot of these farms are in. You know, Phil and Alyssa came and visited and they saw these farms and the settings and the backdrops, and telling that story is so compelling, but it's also important, right? I think the American farmers kind of disappeared from the story in a lot of ways. We go to the grocery store and we get anything and everything we want for really just so cheap. And through that, we've lost a lot of diversity in crops. We've lost a lot of diversity in seeds. I think right now people are excited to be more connected, to understand more. And in order to do that, you know, the people who are using these agrarian products and adding value to them, we have to be the stewards of that story. We have to tell the story and be able to tell the story of, you know, the maltster, the malt house, and the farmer, so that people can trace from, you know, their glass of whiskey down the whole supply chain. And that's what we're excited about.
Brandon, you've got some. I look at your Instagram for Amalga Distillery. Besides having a little kid bouncing around talking about lilac drinks, you've got some. You're working with rhubarb. You're working with a lot of like very seasonal local ingredients. What are you making? You make some whiskey, but you have all these other ingredients that I see all the time.
Yeah, gin and single malt. So as far as a, you know, American craft distillery goes, we're pretty focused. Those are the two products that we make. And we do seasonal variations on our gin using locally produced ingredients. So we do a rhubarb gin, just kind of a fun community thing, but it's also, we're part of a rhubarb cultivation study in the state. And so we're helping farmers by paying top dollar for rhubarb. And they're finding what varieties of rhubarb grow well in the state and doing a bunch of test plots that we're going to help fund. We're helping to fund by buying the product that they're growing so that they can find what rhubarb is the most viable. And supporting a lot of organic farmers through that. We also work with a local native corporation and source literally thousands of pounds of wild blueberries for making a blueberry gin. So we don't make a lot of products, but the products that we do make, we like to utilize local ingredients, whether that's, you know, and when we say local, you know, we really feel like we're a part of the Pacific Northwest. We're as close to Seattle as we are to Anchorage, and all of our waterways connect all of these cities efficiently. And so we like getting our grain from the Pacific Northwest. We like getting our gin ingredients as locally as possible.
And are you drinking anything right now, Brandon?
Oh, boy. Am I ever? I decided to kind of spoil myself and open up a special bottle of Anchorage Brewing Company's Darkest Hour. And this is a cool one because it was made with malt that we commissioned from Main Stem. And it's a smoked malt, but it's an alder smoked malt. One of the whiskeys that we make is an alder smoked whiskey. You know, speaking to the regionality in Alaska, everybody, you know, if you're smoking salmon, if you're smoking anything, you're using alder wood for it. So we wanted to impart that flavor into our whiskey. But we're small, as I said earlier, and we couldn't quite afford a whole lot of the alder smoked whiskey back when we commissioned it. And Anchorage Brewing Company took some, and they made this imperial stout that they age in Woodford Reserve barrels for like a year and a half, and I think it's like clocking in at 15 or 16%. So I'm just having a little tiny snifter of it because it's 1 o'clock in the afternoon. But yeah, it's a beer that we were really excited about, made with Main Stem Malts Alder Smoke.
Anchored down in Anchorage, Alaska. Wow, man, we're really covering a lot of territory today. Back to Kether or Phil, what is market-driven conservation? That's worth talking more about because that's pretty interesting.
Yeah, well, Jimmy, that's getting back to the idea of that you have multiple ways to go about getting conservation projects landed. One is through government incentives. Like there are a lot of programs that farmers can sign up for to get very specific kinds of projects done, like planting trees and shrubs near a creek to provide shade for the water. There's plenty of nonprofits that rely on big donors and just the whole nonprofit complex to fund conservation projects of a wide range of types. And, during the previous administration, there was a lot of there was a lot of fear that, very rightfully so, that funding was drying up for those things and that conservation wasn't getting prioritized. So this is as, you know, as we're entering into the main stem with the idea of like having basically the consumer market-based to us means the consumer is ultimately footing the bill for conservation work. So we see it as this way to provide through all these, through connections, spanning the supply chain, be able to sell the end consumer, you know, the beer, spirits fans out there, sell them on the idea that there are a lot of cool things that can be done throughout the supply chain, all the way back to conservation on family farms, and just get them to pay a bit more for the products. And if they can do that, and then there's continuity in how that premium that they're willing to pay flows through the artisans who are making the beer and spirits, and through the maltster, and through you know, through the farms themselves, that you can create this really clean linkage between consumer willingness to pay and like cool stuff being done all the way back as far as family farms. So,
you know, it's cool about these crowdfunders. I actually have a friend. I think that they're meant to do good, aren't they? Because I have a friend, he's a mezcal importer, and he's doing a different type of crowdfunder, but he also works with a lot of small mezcal producers in Mexico, and they want to grow. And the only way they can grow is if their market grows in the States. How do you see what Mainstem's doing? And tell me, who wants to tell me about the WeFunder? Because it's pretty cool. Like, why would Brandon put $1,000 into it if he's a customer?
Sure. Brandon can tell you that for sure. But the whole idea, I mean, it was a natural for us because, all right, yeah, we're this supply chain company where we provide a ingredient for artisans and, you know, the food and beverage industry. That has been done a whole lot. There's no shortage of suppliers out there looking to pester folks like Brandon and his lovely wife, Maura. The real magic can happen when we're also capturing the imagination of the consumer. And so we want to at the very least show them what's going on in supply chains. But then with WeFunder or regulation crowdfunding in general, which is the way that everyday people can invest in companies like ours and a tequila company or a mezcal company, it's a way for if you have a business that's attractive enough to the consumer that they just can have that mechanism to put money in and buy stock. So, and there's a bunch of different formats. You can do debt-based, like where the consumer essentially, everyday investors can put money in for a loan, or there's like Kickstarter where it's, you're just buying the, you're pre-ordering the product. But I think, yeah, you're right. The commonality here is that in all these projects is there has to be something that's attractive to the consumer. And it turns out right now that the consumer enjoys things that are willing to pay for things that make them feel good about the whole process.
That sounds great. But you guys are actively still running this crowdfunder, right?
We are, yeah. So far, so we're about halfway through. We've raised $109,000 from 140 investors, and this is we have our cap set at $1 million. So we'll raise up to $1 million if folks will be so inspired to support us to that degree. But I think we're entering a really interesting time for the raise. So this is like we're entering in the second half. We have, you can take a look at wefunder.com/mainstemmalt, MAINSTEMMALT. But it's a setup that you can now see. Anyone going to the site can see we've got a bunch of people that really believe in us. there's this cohesive vision for how we're going to grow this thing. There's a lot of opportunities, so we have room to move and take advantage of, you know, various opportunities depending on how things go in the next year or 2 years. And so I think we're already starting to see there are people coming out of the woodwork that are rather influential, and that could change the trajectory. Any one of them could change the trajectory of our business for good. So yeah, it's a neat time to be running this thing. And regardless of how much money we raise with it, it's this way to really like get out there, get the message out there about like, yeah, this is, we're raising money to build a business. And so it's a way to show people what the business means and, you know, why we would want to raise $1 million to support growth. So, and then we have this added layer of, we realized pretty early on in organizing this thing that, oh my gosh, there's like all these, you know, there's this a huge outcry for diversity, equity, inclusion, social equity, and justice, and that we're effectively without any barriers inviting anybody to invest in the company. So we are inviting an unprecedented degree of diversity into the company, whether we embrace it or not. So we just decided, hey, this is,
yeah. But just by doing this, you guys are raising the profile of craft malt, and it is that part of what you're doing, Emily, too, is trying to raise the profile of craft malt?
Yeah, I love the way that you said that, Jimmy. I think I've really dedicated my career to that at this point. And it felt like a natural fit to get involved with Mainstem and on this level. When we were brainstorming what this campaign slogan should be, put your money where your malt is, got thrown out as a joke, but it ended up really sticking because that's exactly what we're all doing, right?
Oh, this is great. This ties it all together for me. You know, like I said, just a few years ago, I met Aaron McLeod. You all know him at Hartwood College, you know, great mind of craft malt. And he tried to put it in perspective for me. He said he grew up working in like the Western Canada large malt industry. And he said, we're talking about maybe having a shipping container of malt going out for craft maltsters while they were sending out, you know, hundreds of full train loads of malt for export. And I think that's really sum up the scales we're talking about, Phil or Kether. Like you guys are talking, you're still like craft, what craft beer is supposed to be. You're talking about, am I on track with that? Yes. I'm looking for you guys to help me sell this. That's why. So.
Scale has a lot to do with it. And so the craft malt definition right now is capped at 10,000 metric tons of malt production per year. So it kind of sounds like a lot, but a truckload is about 32 metric tons about. And so, yeah, it doesn't take too many truckloads of grain to account for a maxed out plant. Montana Craft Malt is at that upper end of the scale. And yeah, the idea is you can't get too big before you lose what's really special about craft malt. And that's the ability to make these local to regional connections between farmers and brewers and distillers and other users of malt. So, yeah.
And then what about like the safety of, you know, one thing that came up in COVID and I actually liked it. Tom Vlasic, the new Secretary of Agriculture, mentioned the security of like regional food systems. Is there an aspect of that as well?
Yeah. So statewide, we have a massive food security initiative. You know, we're accessible by boat and by plane. And, you know, you mentioned COVID and we saw borders completely shut down.
And, you know, everything that comes to Alaska, if it's not coming on a roadway, is going to be because we're not physically connected to any part of the country, needs to come via plane or water. And so, you know, in the state, we're looking at food security, and a major part of food security is bringing back this agrarian aspect that has been kind of, with efficiencies and transportation, kind of forgotten in the state. And we offer a unique way to develop the infrastructure that you need for agriculture and create a high dollar value agrarian product, and basically have all of the tools that you need for food security, while facilitating the growth of a whole new industry for the state. So for the state of Alaska, it's a really interesting component.
Yeah, we talked a lot about this stuff. I want to thank you guys. The beer I'm drinking, I got to sit with a one of my favorite New England brewers, Todd Mott, at Tributary up in Maine the other day, and he made a riff on a classic, if those of you know, a Doppel-Dunkel Weizen called Aventinus. He's got one that he's going to submit to GABF. It's called Cultivator. It's a Doppel-Dunkel Rogan Bock. So that's using rye instead of wheat. And just that kind of beer sings to me. I'm really interested more in the different types of grains that can be used in beer and in whiskeys. And I'm really glad that we had this conversation. So thanks, everybody. Does anybody want to wrap this one up? Because there's a lot of things we could still talk about, but we're going to run out of time. Emily, you want to wrap this one up?
Yeah, I want to say thank you for your emphasis on craft malt this summer and your willingness to continue learning about it. I feel like I send you a lot of information about craft malt lately, and you've been very receptive. So thank you.
Well, thanks. And, you know, I'm learning more about the whole Craft Maltsters Guild. It's great that you're a part of that, Phil. You know, I got just 10 years ago, I was just learning about this. And in 2014, it was the first time I met Andrew Stanley of Valley Malt, and we did an event in New York City where we had 20 different Northeastern brewers play around with small batches of Valley Malt, and half of them had never done that before. So we've come a long way, and I still think the best beers that I get are at least playing with different grains and malts, and I'd like to be able to see a differentiation between different craft malts as when beers are judged. You know, is anyone doing that? Where I know you guys have the steep method, and we talked to Kether, you're doing the steep method to test what malt you might want to put in your beer. But are any beers being judged based on the quality of the malt?
You know, that's a great question. So far, the Craft Maltsters Guild, as a component of Craft Malt Conference, which, quick plug, will be February 18th through the 26th in an in-person and virtual context in 2022. That'll be held in Portland, Maine, the in-person part of it. And then the virtual part will be open for everybody. So check it out if you want to learn more about craft malt. But one of the pieces of that is the malt cup, and that's open to all maltsters, craft and otherwise. And it's a competition specifically to test your metal as a maltster, with like the quality of the malt you can provide to the market. Right now we don't have an equivalent competition for judging beer or spirits by their usage of craft malt, or malt in general. So, but that is a really good point.
Well, I tell you what, we're going to talk, because we're up in the Northeast. We'll get some brewers. We could probably do a mini version of a malt cup of brewers, maybe five brewers are brewing with the same malt or something like that. We'll have some fun with this. And thank you guys again. I'm going to close out. Phil, Emily, Kether, and Brandon, thanks for joining me here on Heritage Radio Network. Big shout out to our engineer, Armin Spengen, and assistant producer, Caroline Fox. I'm Jimmy Carboni. We'll catch you next time on Beer Sessions Radio. All right. Thanks, guys. Thank you.
Beer Sessions Radio is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries, like why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode. Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.
For listening.